Welcome back to episode 108 of Chess Journeys, Tales of Adult Improvement. Here on Chess Journeys, we seek to not only highlight the glories of ratings gain, which is great, but also dive into the plateaus, which is the norm, and the pits of despair below that, which I don't know, maybe I'm pulling out of. We'll see. If you want to support the show, you can go to Patreon Chess Journeys. I do want to thank the Queen Level supporters. Matt Bush, Jay Garrison, Donna Rich Burgess, Brandon Hallside, David Schreiber, Lindsay Newhall, Jeff Peterson, Tobias Rex, Bob Berger, Nicholas Harrison, Rich Bradley Fenner, and our King Level supporter, Ian Samples. I've been streaming on Dr. Skull underscore Tiny Grimes, especially my puzzle journey as of late. And lately, I've been putting up clips of the podcast twice a week as shorts on YouTube. Who knows? Maybe TikTok. I don't know. I don't know if they'll let me on that site. Maybe I'm too old. I don't know the rules of that. I'll have to check into that. If you want to appear on the show, you can fill out the Google form in the show notes. We do all want to hear your story. And if you're interested in Noel Studer's next level training program, you can use the show notes below, and they will also help support the show. Okay, well, this week we have on Jesse Cry. He is an accomplished member of the chess dojo. He's a grandmaster. He runs the dojo with Coach Chikavutsky and David Proust. He recently won the U.S. National Tournament of Senior State Champions. And as an adult who reached GM as an adult, as a person who's an adult trying to improve their game, I thought it'd be a great time to reflect on his most recent accomplishments, what he did to achieve it, and what he is doing now to improve his game even further as he prepares for more senior event domination. So Jesse, welcome to the show. And have you had a chance to play any chess yet today?
I studied some chess. Yeah, I definitely studied some chess.
Okay, nice. What does that mean for you when you say you studied some chess?
Books, you know, as an example today, I finished The Best Move by Jansen Hort. I kind of went through it. I'm going to do probably a book review of that soon. And then I just got turned on to this book called 45 Techniques of Positional Play.
Okay.
And, you know, like a lot of books, I get turned on to it because someone posts something about it on Twitter. And so, you know, Peter Heine Nielsen did like a whole video of the thing on Chessable.
Yeah.
And that inspired me to be like, oh, well, maybe I should check the book out. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's just an example. I've been studying that book this morning. And it's the rationalization I have for studying so much is it's both enjoyable for me, hopefully good for my chess. And then, you know, maybe if it's a good book, we'll use it in the dojo. You know, so that's my morning. I try to do that every morning, some kind of study.
What's interesting to me about those two books you just named is I'm currently going through Techniques of Positional Play, which makes me think, whoa, maybe this is way too high level for me, though I do feel like I'm getting stuff out of it. And I'm working on The Best Move by Jansen Hort, but I think at a very different level. The way I do it is it's a very challenging part of my day where I'll take 15 minutes knowing I'm going to get it wrong, but I'm going to be able to understand my thinking process better. You know, see what a better player would come up with. I don't get many of them right. Are you getting most of those right?
The Best Move is very difficult, dude. Okay. It's very difficult, but I like it a lot as a book. For one, it's pre-computer, so you can argue with the book. I know there's several answers that are wrong according to the computer, but it's still, I think it makes it a more rich experience because these are positions that, like a lot of these problem books now are just computer driven, like some computer found an answer to the problem. And back in the day, these people were collecting positions that were amazing and they had stories behind them and either like that have to do with chess culture or have to do with chess understanding on a human level. And that, so, yeah, I love that book. And then, you know, this Techniques of Positional Play, I'm only one chapter in, but it's maybe it's a refresher for me, but I was interested in it to kind of get words out of it. Like if I kind of want the 45 methods to be named, I think things are good when they're named. It's not actually named as we're like, well, I guess we're kind of sort of talking about restrictions. No, boss, I want something more. I want something more. But the examples are great. And I think no matter, you know, a chump GM level that I'm at, there's a lot of questions I have about, you know, what's going on in a lot of these positions, you know?
Okay. Yeah. And he does name a bunch of stuff. And I like it, like what you're saying has helped me. So like Smyslov's rooks and how he arranges his rooks and queen as a whole section. And yeah. I remember it specifically because he calls it Smyslov's Rooks. And so okay, I'm like, yeah. Oh yeah, that's a Smyslov's Rooks setup. Whereas otherwise it'd be this nebulous piece of knowledge I have that I'm sure I would forget at some point. So I agree. The naming mechanism helps a lot.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's jump into your background a bit. I don't actually know the full like story of Jesse Cry. I've heard some bits and pieces, but you know, when did you pick up chess as a kid? Were you a prodigy at an early age? Were you sort of a late bloomer? What is the story like? When did you start playing chess?
So, you know, I grew up in Santa Fe, New Mexico before the internet. It's a big deal when you think about versus now. There was some chess, considering that we were such a small state. There was some. But I didn't get really turned on to it until like 12. It was very late, and maybe it partly to do because I was from the wrong side of the tracks. You know, the rich kids were already into it in like elementary school, and I actually got turned on to it because I had a friend who was on the other side of the tracks, you know. So anyways, I started late, and I fell in love with chess pretty early as like the intellectual experience I was hoping to find at school but never got. You know, I think a lot of people are like that. There's just something beautiful is opening up in front of you. Whereas in school, everything is intellectual and only intellectual in the sense of like, well, if you don't do this, you're not going to get a job and then you're going to die by the freeway. You know? That's the only intellectual impetus you have, you know?
As a high school teacher, this really saddens me, by the way.
You know, and a lot of times that's what now that I'm older, I appreciate it. It would have been hard to try to motivate us, man. We were rough kids.
Yeah. Okay. So you pick up the game at like 12. Mm-hmm. Was it pretty clear to you immediately that you were going to be good, or were you always kind of like trailing behind because you picked it up so late?
Well, you know, it's a totally different landscape back then where it wasn't clear. Like even if you were good that you could like make a living at it, and all the messaging from chess players and non-chess players was boss, this is not something you want to do with your life, which is really a bummer. It's really a bummer, man, because then I, you know, kind of following that after high school, you know, I went to undergraduate, then after undergraduate I went and did my PhD and stuff, and it was only after all that that I got back into the game. It was a totally different ecosystem back then where, you know, in terms of people, there were so few gigs. I remember as a kid, like the best gig that I could imagine as a kid was like maybe Andy Soltis's column writing for Chess Life. Now, when I think about that gig now, I'm like, oh God, I would never or like the burn column in the New York Times. I'd be like, oh, that was the height, dude. That would have been it. And now I'm like, oh God, that would never want that thing, you know? But that was kind of what it was back in the day. There was very few opportunities. And the whole explosion of teaching kids hadn't really happened. It had happened probably on the East Coast some, obviously New York City and stuff, but definitely not where I was doing anything.
Okay. And what was this, like the 80s, 90s?
80s, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, it felt like that. I picked up chess in the very early 2000s, and it still kind of felt like that. Like I met a bunch of masters, and most of them lived with their parents and like had these lives that I did not aspire to, right? I was like, wow, that's like the pinnacle. You become master and this is your life? Oh, wow. And so I did the same thing. I was like, grad school looks much more appealing than this particular journey. I'll put this on hold until I retire and then I'll come back to chess. So yeah, it's interesting how many more opportunities there are now for people. And what's fascinating is you don't even have to be good at chess now to have opportunities, right? As long as you are an engaging person, you could be a streamer who, is trying to educate lower level people. Like you said, you can teach chess in schools. And, you know, I was 1,000 teaching chess in schools and, I was a god to those children. So all ratings are welcome now for making a living at chess, which I think is fascinating. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so let's see. How did your journey go then? Like when you were, say, like a late teen, were you playing in tournaments? Were you striving for any sort of
Or
anything?
Oh, yeah. I was studying all night long and then falling asleep at school. And, you know, I should have just dropped out. But, you know, it was kind of parental pressure and stuff. And all you had to do was show up to graduate. That's all you had to do, man. So I showed up and I graduated. But I was studying chess all the time. I tried to sneak chess books into class. It wasn't that hard, honestly. And but then I got I wasn't interested in school at all. And then I got a scholarship to this tiny school that doesn't exist anymore, a chess scholarship. Called Scheimer, and it was actually like a really great school, and then that's kind of began my academic journey, you know. And because I was on a chess scholarship, I think then I was exposed to chess and I kept playing, whereas maybe if I hadn't been, that would have kind of petered out. And that kind of is the beginning of a whole like collegiate era, right? Because then it was first UMBC and then the Texas schools, and then kind of like right after I kind of started going to college, that turned into a thing. And the whole arms race began in the college sphere because they realized with little money, with really the example of UMBC, University of Maryland, Baltimore County, they realized with a little bit of money, you could put your college on a map. You know, that's what they realized early.
I never heard of that college before chess.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So what, like, let's say you're graduating high school, what's your rating looking like? Are you like, you know, a master by then? Are you much lower than that?
USCF, I think I was around like 2340 or something like that.
Okay. So you are a USCF master. Are you a FIDE master yet?
No, that came later. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you are USCF master going to college on a chess scholarship. What kind of stuff did you do to get to USCF master? I mean, you said you studied a lot. What did that look like for you? Were there some books that you really remember as, you know, making a big mark on you?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, all those books were random because they were just the books that were in the library, the public library. You know,
okay.
That's what they were, you know. And then books I would find, like if I went to a big tournament, they would have like a, you know, tournament. You know, bookstore. And then I would check out and find stuff. And sometimes people would give you gifts and stuff. But books that I remember making an impact weren't necessarily the best books, but they made an impact was Korshnoi's 400 Best Games, Irving Chernev with the 60 Most Instructive Games. And then kind of by chance, this dude added one of the Denkers gave me Bobby Fischer's Collected. And that I just studied every game in that book. Huge tome, you know. And you know, then I had like the opening manuals, stuff like that. Yeah, but I didn't have a teacher. I did get to go to what I feel like is the precursor to the U.S. Chess School, and Greg Chahada hates it whenever I mention this, but it was like a beautiful thing at the Marshall Chess Club where I got to go twice, where Edmar Mendes taught a bunch of us for like a week. And that was fantastic, you know, also not just the instruction, but like getting to hang out with other kids of my generation who were, you know, into it.
Yeah. And how did you get selected for something like that? Were you, you know, at the top of the rating list for your age group?
Yeah. Back in the day, it was like, yeah, just the top kids got selected.
Okay. So you were sort of like one of the top people of the rating list for your age, but that number is just so much lower than it would be today.
That's mostly fair. I wasn't the best, you know, like I feel like in my generation, you had the best in terms of the year I was born was definitely Ilya Gurevich. He lives in New York City now, hasn't played for years. That guy was amazing, you know, and then we had Alex Scherzer, unfortunately now dead. That guy was amazing. We had Vivek Rao, doesn't play anymore. You know, there was a bunch of people who were very talented. And it's funny, I was reflecting with Dean Ippolito, a couple of years younger than me. And he's going for it, the GM. You should interview him. He's going for it at a very late age.
Nice.
And we kind of had this moment. We were hanging out. We're like, oh my God, we are the only ones left of our generation. And seriously, like they're all gone.
Oh, you know?
And it was this very, and we would talk a little bit more about that maybe later, but that was just this interesting thing that all those people are not playing anymore.
Yeah. And do you think a lot of that has to do with the lack of opportunity in that period, that it just, there wasn't as much of a reason to push to, you know, whatever heights of glory you could achieve. And did a bunch of people dip out to other careers and things like that?
That's definitely a part of it. Yeah. It's definitely a part of it. And I think a lot of those people actually like quit cold turkey in a kind of very cruel way, cruel to themselves way, you know, and they were just like, I can't do it anymore. I'm going to stop, you know? And I had the advantage, you know, after my academic period, I went to Germany. I was doing my PhD there and I got to play in the Bundesliga. And it was just this beautiful ability to, you know, play with strong players and you'd hang out with them and talk. And it was like an experience of chess culture. But, you know, in the States back then, and even now, it was not too much chess culture. And it was just like, you know, these sad Swiss system tournaments, you know, where they have people scrunched together on all these little plastic boards with 1,000 different clocks and no one knows how to work them. You know, that was the experience. And it was just kind of unjoyful in addition to the monetary problem, you know, in addition to that. And also like the people doing it at that time, like, you know, teaching kids is fine. There's nothing wrong with it, but it is kind of a dead end situation. I've done my time there. You know, I've done a lot of teaching of kids. It's helped my game, honestly. I mean, it helps to teach, but at the same time, it's like, it's kind of depressing and it's taxing, you know? And so a lot of those people, you know, tried out that road and then ended up bowing out.
Yeah. It feels to me like you just have to either be naturally loving it, or it's like, it takes so much energy that you only have so much energy you can give to that group before you're like, okay, I can't do this anymore. It takes too much energy. That was the experience I had. That was the hardest teaching I've ever done, was to kindergartners who didn't want to learn chess, but their parents signed them up for it anyway. And it was my job to make it interesting and teach them anyway. Boy, that was a hard gig.
Oh yeah, I bet. Yeah. I've been there. I've done that one. Yeah.
Yeah. That was a tough one. So it's pretty fascinating though, that if you picked up chess at like 12, you were able to become one of the elite people in your age range. What do you think it was that allowed you to do that? Was it just the dedication you put in, you know, ignoring school and just going full on chess? Did you feel like you had this natural talent, or you found, you know, the perfect match for your talent?
You know, I guess I had to have some kind of natural talent. I don't know really how to quantify that. But there have been other people started late. You know, for example, I got to hang out with John Fedorowicz. He's older than me, but he started at like 14. Hmm. That guy became much stronger than I ever was. You know, one of the top players in the 70s and 80s. And then, of course, Shankland also started really late. He had the benefit of growing up in the Bay Area, but still, you know, he started late.
Yeah.
So it's definitely possible to start late. But in terms of like reaching the very top, it's hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine somebody reaching the very top and starting so late.
Yeah, it's so great to hear, because a lot of my audience starts late, right? And then also to hear you say it's hard to imagine reaching the very top, I think most of my audience would look at you, Jesse, cry and be like, what are you talking about? You're a grandmaster. You have reached the top.
No. Yeah.
Yeah, grandmaster. It's hard to even fathom that there's like the whole tiered system of grandmasters, whereas us regular players down here are just like, you're all gods. You're all in the pantheon somewhere. You might just be lower in the pantheon.
Right.
Okay. So when did you, so you said you were a USCF master, you go off to grad school. When did you decide to like rededicate yourself? Was there a moment you were like, I'm going for IM, I'm going for GM? Or did you just start playing chess again and then the titles kind of came?
Well, I made IM while I was in Germany. And then I got a gig working at a college in my hometown of Santa Fe. And there was kind of like a breaking of my naivete moment where, you know, the same way I fell in love with chess, I fell in love with academia. And I kind of had a naive belief about like what it was all about, you know. Mm-hmm. And in Germany, it was kind of like a hardcore, almost militaristic culture around academia. It was very masculine and kind of like chess. And it was like, you know, you were essentially brawling with each other in this academic world. You know, you get back and it's just like, no, buddy. You got to be really nice and sweet to these little children who are paying a lot of money to go to this school, you know, and then Christ shows up with his like Germanic demeanor. And I had like the German glasses and stuff. Oh, dude, they didn't like me, you know, and I thought I was just the shit going on there, man, you know. And so I had kind of like a crude awakening of what the academic world was actually like on the other side. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, there's kind of maybe an experience in that, you know, you play a bunch of chess and then you're like, oh, my God, I'm teaching children. Well, in the academic world, it's not dissimilar. Right. Yeah. And then in the academic world, it's worse, though, because you are not your own boss and you got to deal with all this politics. And oh, my God. Dude. Oh, my God. Welcome to the world, Jesse. And at least in the chess world, there's like a metric. There's a metric that's honest. And maybe you will, your rating won't go up, but it's at least it's there to tell you something that's real feedback instead of just some university clown telling you that they like you or they don't like you, mm-hmm. you know? So that's very, something very refreshing about chess that I still enjoy. Yeah. Anyways, I stopped there. And then I kind of had the thought, this was 2002. I was like, I can make GM in a year or two.
You know? Wow.
I could do it, buddy. Nice. No, it was more like 5 years, buddy. And there was more like, there was some moments of despair in there. I can promise you that, because that rating graph was not moving and I was working hard at it. And so, yeah, that was a 5-year journey then, 2002, 2007. And right, I was an older dude. No one thought I could do it. They were all like, no, boss, you're done. You're done. You're just some chump. I don't know what you're doing here. Anyways, I made it. Yeah.
Okay. How did you make it? Did you go to GM norm tournaments and things like that?
Yeah. Nonstop.
Okay. So you'd go to these norm tournaments and everyone's like, cool, Cry's here. Yeah. He's not going to do it, but he donates the money. He comes. It's great.
You know, it was a whole Fight Club experience back in the day because there was so little money and it would just be sometimes, you know, some random people like David Bruce would organize a tournament in a random church basement. We'd show up there and we'd brawl and there was a camaraderie to it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And everyone is just dirt poor. Yeah, so it's a beautiful time.
So you made it. And what do you feel like contributed to you being able to make that jump from IM to GM? Are there any books? Are there any strategies you did? Or is it just, you know, perseverance?
A lot of it I kind of is laid out now in the Chess Dojo training program. And the heart of the program is analyzing your own games. It's a hard thing to learn how to analyze your own games. But I definitely think that is the centerpiece of anybody improving. It's usually something that when they hear that, they're like, oh, Cry, whatever. Or they'll try it and they'll come up with like half a page of notes and be like, this is dumb. There's no questions here. So anyways, it's a process and you have to get good at it. But that was the main thing that put me on my path. And there's a bunch of books, you know, that I read along the way that were obviously helpful. Definitely the experience of playing against, you know, strong GMs and IMs and just, you know, fighting it out was also very helpful.
Okay. Yeah. I've heard you many times talk about this idea of annotating your own games. And I both agree with you. Like, I think it's amazing, but I often wonder, like, is that really it? Or is there like all these other things you should be doing? And that's just a part of the journey.
Yeah. There's definitely other things to do. You know, I'm reading, but to this day, I still kind of follow the same program. I study my games. And then when I'm done studying them, I'll read books, you know, do stuff. Yeah.
Okay.
We have sparring in the dojo too. You know, I like that a lot.
Yeah. I think the sparring is one of the coolest parts of the dojo. How you guys isolate positions and then you can find partners that way. I think that's a really great idea.
Yeah.
All right. Would you mind telling our listeners here how you suggest that people annotate their games? Because I annotate all my games, but Jesse, I get like a half a page of notes and I'm very proud of myself. And I'm like, look, I spent 45 minutes. I put down my thoughts, my feelings, lines, like this is gold right here. And it sounds like you're saying like, hey man, that's just the beginning. You just one. How should people do this?
Well, one thing we did at the dojo I really like is, you know, if someone goes and looks at my notes, and there's a couple, you go online, you do Cry notes or something, that the dude from Chess Base India, Shagar Shah, that dude like actually transcribed my notes from like photocopies. I just made some photocopies because people were asking me, but that dude sat down, like, you know, figured out the hieroglyphics of my whole notes and posted it anyway. So that there's an examples out there the way I've done it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that your notes have to look like that. And so one of the things I like what we did at the dojo is we put together what the best annotated games of each cohort look like. So for example, a cohort is just a 100-point rating band, right? And so we found annotations from, let's say, 900 players, from 1200 players that were really well done. And it's going to look different depending on your rating level. You're going to be asking different questions, right? So one of the cool things about that is help me also visualize, right, you know, the questions are different at the different rating levels, but you can ask questions, right? And they're just different at a 900 level where we're mostly talking about not hanging stuff, you know, and then we advance up the ladder and the questions become a little bit more involved. And, you know, the amazing thing is when you annotate the games, especially without the computer, you're going to get a bunch of things wrong, but you are trying to articulate what's happening, right? And then you might get feedback from a coach, you might get feedback from other people. But the most amazing thing is, if you tell yourself, oh, I'm going to publish it, like here, all you're doing, it's not an epic publishing, it's just like you're just publishing it on the Dojo database, but you know, they're like, okay, I'm writing it for somebody out there, right? And so maybe the one thing I took from academia, I'm just kidding, there's probably more than one thing I took from academia, but I do believe that clear writing is clear thinking. And so if you can try to be as clear as possible, boom, oh yeah. Because that's what you need. You need clear thinking when you're in the heat of the battle. You know, you need to figure out what's going on. Okay. Yeah, so as I said, it's a journey in terms of annotating the games, but it's very possible. And, you know, you just realize that at the beginning, your notes won't be amazing. You know, you shouldn't expect them to be absolutely amazing.
Yeah, I like that. I think I write mine with an audience in mind of my coach. So that when we go over the games, he's inevitably going to ask me, hey, why did you make this move? It looks like a weird move. Mm-hmm. And before I started really thinking about those moments, my answer would be like, I don't remember. And that's not that helpful, right?
Yeah, not that helpful.
So now right after the game, I like make a mark in my scorebook. I you're not allowed to take notes, right? So I write down the time of the move on moves where I'm like, I need to make a note of this move. And then I go back to my scorebook and I start there and I'll say like, here's my feelings here. Here's why I made this move. And then we can have a conversation about it. And it's usually like, Kevin, feelings don't matter. Like, it doesn't matter how you were feeling. How about you just calculate some lines and then that's your answer. And I'm like, well, I was trying, but you know, there was an attack and it was worrying me. Or lately I've moved into this new mode where I'm like, no attacks worry me. And he's like, hey, your opponent has four pieces on your king and you're not reacting. And I'm like, I don't think that attack's real. And he's like, what? What are you talking about?
Yeah.
That's it's interesting. So when you're talking about notes, are you thinking doing it right after the game? Do you have different levels in mind where you do it like right after the game with some feelings and then later diving deeper, or what does that process look like for you?
Personally, you can do it different ways, but I generally try to get in a rhythm where I show the coach one game a week. So I'll spend all week on that game. Sometimes it's not enough time, but that'll be about usually 10 to 12 pages of notes, maybe, you know, 10 to 15 hours of work. And the coach is great. And one of the things that's funny as myself being a coach, and I've had several students try to do this, they are often lazy for the coach in the sense that they're like, when we get there, me and Cry will figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have to go too deep here. You know, what's the problem, Cry? Cry, just tell me what the answer is. Whereas if you publish it, it's interesting. And it only hit me when we did it with the dojo that it's like this thing that Bob Vinick was talking about with publishing your analysis. It forces you to be clear. And of course, like only Bob Vinick back in the day could publish everything. No one else could like publish. So like, it's not like everybody got to publish their games. Well, you know, now you kind of can.
Yeah.
So that's one cool thing about it that I think is important to the process. You know, and if you don't do it with the dojo, you could publish it on your blog. You could, there's a variety of ways that you could publish
your analysis. For all the chess punks out there, you could just put your games on Twitter. Just do like a 100 Twitter thread with all your analysis of one game. It'd be amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's a great start. So it sounds like we have a number of places you can go for more information. Go over to the dojo. You can look for one of Jesse's examples. I'm going to try to find that and post a link in the show notes because I'm personally fascinated myself. I got to see this because I can't imagine writing 15 pages about my games. They're not that good, right? It'd be like, okay, I played the opening pretty well. Here, I made a weird move. There's like six big moments in the game. And then otherwise, I played whatever. It was fine. It wasn't special. Mm. So I don't know. It's hard for me to imagine writing that much about a single game.
Yeah, check it out.
Is your coach ever like, hey, Jesse, come on, man. This is too much. Like, I don't want to go through all of these notes. Or is your coach like, yes, this is where we figure out where the where we can do our hard work?
Oh, yeah. So one time he was like, I missed some tactic. And he's like, sometimes, you know, you don't go that deep in your analysis. Well, in your game too, it shows. I can't do his accent that good, but it's kind of like that.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Okay. So your 15 pages isn't even enough sometimes.
Well, you know, and what he was saying is that sometimes I'm not going deep enough in the variations.
Yeah.
We're seeing all the ideas.
Wow. Okay. And I guess that's how you find out if you are, right? If you put down all of your thoughts, all of your ideas, then you're going to see where you stopped your analysis and find those points. That's really interesting. All right. I want to talk real quick about the senior tournament before we get into like adult improvement advice.
Sure.
So I turned 50 very soon, and I'm quite excited about this prospect of playing in senior events. What's been your experience with them?
Okay, so I got, you know, 2 weekends away. I had to negotiate that with the ex-wife. Man, that was hard. 2 weekends. One was for the senior open in Chicago. And then the other one was this Irwin Tournament of Senior State Champions. Both of them being qualifiers to the U.S. Senior Closed, right? Beautiful new thing for people over 50 to aspire to, right? And in addition, of course, a lot of states have their senior chess championship. Not all of them do. My state, Maryland, it's just like the top placing senior in the open.
Hmm.
Right. But that gives, I know a lot of people like something to work forward to. And in general, I think it's great to have something like that. I know for certain that one of the reasons I became a GM was back in the day, beginning 2001 and 2002 and on, you could qualify for the U.S. championship. And so that was like my big thing every year was trying to qualify. And then I did it. I played, I think, 5 times in the U.S. championship. That was a great experience. And also it was something to focus on, like a goal. And so now, right, I have this senior event stuff. It's really cool. And it's a little bit social as well. You know, I know some people, hang out, we go, you know, go out to dinner, whatever. And it's so much different, of course, than if I go to an open and it's a bunch of kids that I don't even know. I don't even know who they are, you know? And they, you know, so it gives me something to look forward to. Anyways, I just want to do that as the backdrop. It's a new thing with senior chess. I feel like the last 5 years, it's kind of come to be a thing. And I really appreciate it as it's a very interesting social experiment, really, because people do get worse as they age. No one likes to hear it. I got to hang out with James Altucher there. He had a great event, by the way. I know he was on your show. And he's always trying to say that, you know, he's very optimistic. You know, he's got the brand of being somebody who can do anything and, you know, go get them kind of podcast. But it's tough, dude. And people aren't really getting better. And one of the things that I just hit me was so amazing was for the like, let's say the last 20 years, okay, there have been three of us that have kind of had the exact same rating graph. And that's been Enrico Seviano. He made GM at a later age too. And Malik Kashian, me and him, both those guys, I roomed with them. We hung out, traveled some together, went to tournaments, and we all peaked at like FIDE 25, 20 or 30 or something like that. And then we all came crashing down. But then the amazing thing is, Blake, of course, had this great result where he won the U.S. Senior. And it was surprising because the people in the U.S. Senior are, I'll just say it because I feel like me and Malik are on the same level, it might sound crude, but they have more knowledge. They are better players than me and Malik. But they're not playing that much, right? They don't want to play these Indian kids in the tournament, dude. They're just hanging on to their rating and playing one tournament a year. So he went in there and he mopped up and it was like, oh, interesting. Interesting. Really interesting. Yeah.
Okay. So is that your goal? Are you going to really work hard for the next year so you can go in next year?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm okay. Yeah. And I enjoy studying and it's really cool then for me to have something to look, you know, forward to as a challenge.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The senior events seem really intriguing to me. Because I feel like now I get to be the young kid in the room. Like, I have a feeling people are going to look at me and be like, what? What are you doing here?
You still got hair, buddy.
50? Yeah, so it'd be fun. And I don't know. I just kind of like the idea of playing with people who are either on a similar journey as me, trying to get better as an older person. Right. Or maybe just it's not a whole room full of people who are going to steal all my rating points as they come, you know, in at 1200 and then, 6 months later, they're 1800. So I don't know. It seems like an interesting group to be playing with.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, dude. So we got about a year until I see you at these tournaments.
November.
Oh,
a couple months.
There we go. Yeah. What state are you in?
I'm in California, so I will never be our state representative. I have to move. I'm going to do some research. I'm going to find the state with the weakest senior chess players, move there so that I can play in the Irwin senior tournament.
Right.
No, I don't think that's going to happen, but yeah. So it should be fun. Yeah. I'm going to, the one in Chicago, I think I'm going to try to play in that one next summer.
Yeah. That's a fun tournament. Yeah.
Caveman Chess Festival thing. They have a big tournament. So I don't know. We'll see. Maybe it'll happen. All right. Well, last section, I thought we could talk for a bit now about just adult improvement. You have a lot of thoughts on this. You know, you're part of the Chess Dojo. You guys put out so much amazing content. So first step is, of course, join the Chess Dojo. Go check out the Chess Dojo. You're going to get better just by being part of that group. But what do you think sort of generally adults should focus on to improve their game? Are there any areas you've seen that are special places for focus or just generally should be practicing everything? What are your kind of your general thoughts?
Definitely what I observe most of all, especially in the last couple of years where we've had this huge chess boom and everybody's playing online, is that you are seeing players just completely stagnating because they're just playing mostly blitz. And then they kind of understand, but not fully, that they have to play longer games to get better. And let me give you the argument why you have to is that when you are playing blitz, you are not activating your system two. You're not doing deep work. And the reason, and by the way, system two, if you don't know what I'm talking about, this is really deriving from Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow, foundational book when it comes to thinking, but also especially chess thinking. That with system two thinking, you are able to learn new things. System one, playing blitz, you're just repeating the same thing over and over again. And that's the biggest thing that I see with adult improvers. And then often what you hear from them is, oh, I don't have the time. But then curiously, you look at their account and, oh, buddy, they've gone on some binges and you're like, oh, buddy, I think you have the time, Bowers. I think you do have the time because I just can look at your account and see that you played a gazillion games of bullet or 3 minute or whatever. Mm-hmm. And to be fair, I think a lot of people, when they're doing that, they are doing it as an escape from life. And that's fine. People need escapes from life. Sometimes when I'm having lunch, I'll play like Settlers of Catan online. That's very relaxing. And I'm not really trying to get that much better. So if you do it that way, you just don't have any expectations of improving. That's fine. You can play it for fun. But if you do want to improve, you're going to have to do some deeper games. And you can get longer games online. It's possible. And we arrange some of those at the dojo so you're not necessarily playing a cheater and stuff. Because that's a real thing, man, out there. Holy moly, the cheaters. Especially when you get like the 30 minutes or plus. I got some students trying to do that. It's just like, oh, buddy, it's just like every other game, which then becomes really psychologically damaging. Because then you think everybody's cheating you, you know? Mm. Anyways, you got to play those longer games. And it does not help to go over your games if you are going over some game where you weren't really thinking. You got to have some moments in there, some thinks, where you went deep in the tank and it was kind of unpleasant. By the way, your caloric burn increases dramatically when you're doing the system too. So your body, not just your mind, is deliberately trying to shut you down. It's like, just move, boss. Just move. You don't need to be thinking about any of this. Forget about it. Just move, you know? So that's the biggest thing that I've noticed for the adult improvement community.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay. I think that's a pretty reasonable statement. I know when you guys came out with your program, it felt like that was, people were like, love it. Love every part of your program. And then you were like, you need to play X amount of classical games.
Yeah.
Rapid doesn't count, Blitz doesn't count, and people went bananas, right? They were like, what? Right. What do you mean Rapid doesn't count? Rapid's the slowest I play. And you're like, nope, sorry, it has to be classical. And there was a lot of pushback on that. But I mean, the more I play classical, the more I agree, especially with the like the physical side. Like it is tormenting to sit there in a position where you're being suffocated and you're not lost, but it's uncomfortable. And you're sitting there, not for 3 minutes, but for like 3 hours. Like now you understand that temptation to just lash out with like F4 or something to try to break open the position, even if it's terrible. Cause you're like, I just can't endure this anymore. My brain doesn't want it. My body doesn't want it. Mm-hmm. And if you don't put yourself through that, it's hard to get that next breakthrough, the level two thinking, to really think about like, well, how can I avoid these positions then if I hate them so much, or how can I endure them better? Just, you know, whipping through a blitz game. It's just such a different experience.
Yeah. One thing we actually did with the dojo, kind of in recognition of how hard that is like, you don't have to play classical full like 90 plus 30 games until you're like 1600. And then we gradually move it down the line for time controls, you know, getting it faster and faster, because we realized like it takes some time to actually build up the system to muscle to where you're going to be able to sit and actually think, right? Yeah. And and that took us a while. Like there are a lot of things I've learned about chess improvement just like by doing the dojo. And that was something that at first I wanted to be really the jerk about it. You know, I wanted to be the German dude with the glasses, you know? I wanted to be that guy. And then I realized, no, these people can't. They can't think. And it's actually a physical thing where their bucket of the system too isn't ready. You know, so we dialed it up really through the rating bands.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Because I have an 8-year-old who's really into chess. Mm-hmm. Her rating just jumped from 200 to 263. She had a good tournament.
Yeah, nice.
But she plays, you know, 25-minute games. And even those are long for her. They're just they're a little bit too long, but I can see her taking her time, thinking carefully. But boy, if you put her in a game 90 or something, it'd be like torture. Like my opponent just sat there for 30 minutes. It's ridiculous. What's that person even doing? Whereas her opponents, she actually had an opponent who in a game 25 leaned in at one point and went, excuse me, could you please speed up?
That's right, dude. Yeah. They can't take it. They can't take it.
It was hilarious. Yeah. We had a great conversation about that. I was like, you know what that means? And she's like, what? And I was like, just go slower. I'm like, it'll really get to him. Like, he'll really struggle. You know, your full 25 minutes, that's allotted to you. And she can't do that. Like, you know, a 14-minute game for her is like a super long game. So I hear what you're saying. Until we can develop that.
And one of the things we saw at the dojos, we changed the requirement, actually, where if you don't use at least half of the required time, Right? Different rating bands have different requirements. If you don't use half the required time, it doesn't count. And so it forced then people to slow down. And right away, it was like instant. The feedback on our Discord was like, oh, yeah, boss. I saw stuff that I wouldn't have seen. And it makes sense. If you just sit there, maybe even if you close your eyes for a second because you can't take it anymore, but then come back, you're going to find more things. You're going to blunder much less, right, than if you're whipping it out all the time, right?
Yeah. That's such a great point. Wow. I didn't even realize you guys had that in there. You have to use half the time.
We got to use half the time. Yeah.
Okay. I love this. Do you have any suggestions on like what percentage people should be doing on certain things, like opening strategy, end game tactics, or do you feel like it's more of an individualized thing as people should kind of figure out what their strengths and weaknesses are?
I feel like we have a pretty good breakdown. We have these pie charts now with the dojo. That's really cool. Mm-hmm. And roughly like 40 to 50% should be both playing games and annotating them. Right. And then kind of more or less all the same after that would be some openings, less the more if you're rated higher, less if you're rated lower. Mm-hmm. End games, books, which kind of, you know, it's like that could be tournament books, that could be strategy books, but just something with some chess culture where you get exposed to some classic games, right? And then of course tactics. Yeah,
okay, that makes sense. But it sounds like half of it is analyzing your games.
Yeah, and then kind of the rest spread out through those.
And is it because you feel like you just get a lot of that in analyzing your games, like you're going to do a lot of tactics as you're calculating different lines and different possibilities?
Yeah, you're going to get calculation, evaluation, training your intuition, thinking about what your like weird patterns are that you do. And little red lights will start going off for you in your games because it'll be like, oh, I've been this one before. I've seen this one, boss. I know all about it. And then once you recognize your own mistakes, it's not just a personal thing. A lot of people are like, oh, okay, this is a personal journey. I'm learning about my personal failings. No, once you realize some personal failing you have, you will see it in your opponents. You will see it mirrored in their mistakes.
Yeah, you know? That's even better. Then it's easier to isolate them and destroy them.
Destroy them. That's right.
All right. I've seen you recommend all kinds of great books on YouTube and, and your program. Are there any favorite resources you have for adult improvers that have kind of stuck out to you where you're like, yeah, this is the one I recommend just nonstop?
You mean like a book or something? Or
yeah, books would be the main thing that I would think of, but resources could be, you know, anything else, and like maybe it's videos or something.
Well, one of the things we did at the program was like we have the books lined up by cohort. So it's not, we're not recommending the same book for the same, you know, it gets harder and more books as you go up the ladder. So there's not, there's one book that applies across all the spectrum. It would be like the Polgar Mates book. Mm-hmm. But that's just one book where kind of like anybody at any level could do that book, I feel.
Yeah. Yeah. And you did a lot of that book, right?
Oh, I've done that book at least 5 times. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I had a coach tell me that they thought Mate and Twos were pointless.
There's a lot of arrogance, and I had that myself because I was like, Mate and Twos, I could do any of them, you know? And then I realized that wasn't the point, boss. The point was to develop a grip on the board, to visualize squares, and to practice them as if you're practicing layups. So that it becomes boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
And definitely, yeah, that kind of, you know, response. David Bruce, he still won't even try, dude. It's like I'm trying to get him to eat his vegetables, and he's like, no, I'm an IM. I've seen all these patterns before, man. I don't need to do it. And I'm like, boss, at least trust me a little bit, you know, trust the dojo. And he's like, no, I've seen this before. Anyway, so it's not uncommon what you're talking about there.
Okay. I am a little curious. Why don't these IMs revere you as a god? You're a GM. It seems like, you know, in your interactions, they're kind of like, oh, Jesse, like, he doesn't know that much. Like, come on, you're the GM of the group.
Yeah, these chumps, huh? Who do they think they are? Yeah, what are they doing? Yeah.
Okay. All right, I guess next question is then, do you recommend that adult improvers get a coach? Do you think that's an important part of the journey?
It definitely helps, but it's not necessary, and it's very expensive. You know, it's just very expensive. And so I don't think it's necessary. And one of the things that all this happened with the dojo was really like when chess boomed, all kinds of people were writing us for like, be my coach. And we were like, Baus, I can't do everybody. No way. And so the chess, and I also felt bad because I was charging a lot. And I was just like, wait a second. I say the same things over and over again. Let's put it into a formula. Mm-hmm. And I think it's better than a coach in the sense that it's just there always for you to be a scaffolding for you to construct your success. But it definitely, I have a coach and I think it's great. It kind of keeps me honest, especially with the game review.
Okay. So you feel like Chess Dojo kind of is a coach in a way, since it has a program that you go through. Yeah. It allows you to interact with other people, which is part of coaching. And then a coach to supplement that to go through games could be helpful also. But you feel like the dojo is a reasonable supplement for it.
Yeah.
Okay. It seems like you are a good person to ask this question because you have kind of had the ups and downs of trying to improve in ratings. So when someone loses 150 points in 6 months, how do you recommend that people deal with setbacks like this?
Did you lose 150 points, boss?
I might have lost 150 points in 6 months. It's pretty tough. Like I've made posts like I have a divorce now with USCF. Uh-huh. Like you can rate me all you want, but I'm not looking. Uh-huh. Like what's the healthy way to deal with that level of setback?
Well, first of all, I think one of the cool things about chess is like you're going to have setbacks. First of all, that's just going to happen, and then it's kind of a question of personal fortitude, and you're either going to give up or you're going to persevere. And maybe that perseverance is madness. Maybe it's madness. But, you know, one of the things that's very interesting to me as a fan, especially now with the adult improver community, is there's all kinds of people that are more interesting for me to follow, honestly, than say Fabi or a lot of these other people. I love Fabi to bits. I love watching his games, but the guy's not going to improve anymore. He's done. He's done. So, you know, there's all these people and, you know, Chess Von Doom is like maybe 1,000 feet, something like that, you know, well, it'd be cool to see the dude progress. Right. And are these people going to have setbacks? Yeah. But as a fan, I want them to experience that. First of all, you have to know in advance, you're going to have a situation like that. And then it's going to be really interesting to see what kind of personal fortitude you have when you get hit with that situation. Right. Maybe you just quit and that's fine if you do, you know, but that's what, I don't know. There's this whole ecosystem now, right? Where it's all of a sudden really interesting, especially for chess improvers to see like, oh, well, what's going on with Joe? And, you know, what's that journey looking like? I thought I was stunned when I realized that me, Malik and Rico were all the same rating graph. I was like, oh dang. I was like, I saw myself in a mirror, man. I was like, holy moly, you know, and I realize it, you know, they've had some hard times too, and it's all part of the journey, man.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is I should just quit. No, I'm just kidding.
it's interesting actually for you doing this podcast, and I'm sure you'll have other people on talking about different aspects of their journey, but 50 is a real interesting time. And when you go to the senior events, you'll see like just walking around, you got a variety of ailments, but you know, anybody who's 50 has got some kind of ailment, you know. It's not that severe, but people got some ailments and you see it, some of it's neurological, and it's just like people are all, everybody over 50's got something they're dealing with, man. You know, and it's much harder to improve. It's just much harder to improve. And you guys like Altucher, they're still going for it, man. They're still going for it with like big studying. You know, I try to get in a couple hours at least every morning. That guy's going like 4 hours in the morning, and he's got his podcast and he's got like business stuff going on. I'm like, boss, how do you do it, man? He's not deterred yet. And he had a great tournament. And ultimately, you need some kind of positive feedback, right? You do need some kind of positive feedback. And the cool thing for you, of course, is you have this show. So you have like something a kind of feedback loop through the show, and you know, people can kind of follow your journey, which is cool for you. Yeah,
it is interesting. When I started this podcast, or when I got back into chess, I had been playing all these card games where I would be like at an elite level and make a podcast from a expert's perspective. And I got back into chess and I was like, well, that's done. I will never make content from an expert perspective again. And so I never imagined anyone would even care what I was up to. So I was pretty shocked to see that people actually were like, oh, I'm kind of interested in your journey and the journey of other people trying to improve. So it's still kind of boggles my mind that anyone ever listens to the show. So if you're still listening, thanks. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Okay, Jesse. Now I did get some good news. Okay. I just told you, like, I have a divorce from USCF now. I don't even look at my ratings. I don't care.
Yeah.
Well, I had a good tournament and I gained 43 points back. Should I be excited now, or should I just still be like, hey, whatever ratings? Like, I'm really struggling with, like, how do I incorporate ratings into my self-evaluation, into my process? Do I ignore them? Do I try to somehow mitigate the highs and the lows and land somewhere in between? I don't really know what to do with these ratings, because I want to, like, go out and throw a parade that I gained 3 points. But then another part of me is like, no, USCF, I don't care anymore. I'm done with you. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, let me ask you, before you divorced yourself from the rating system, what was your goal?
My goal is twofold. One is just simply to get better at chess. Mm-hmm. And if my rating goes up, cool. If it doesn't, I can accept that. I know I'm older. I don't know how much I can do. But then I gained like 150 points in a year. And I was like, okay, cool. This is working. I'm putting in the time. I am getting better in chess. It is now reflected in my rating. It's a win-win scenario. I would love to hit 2000. That sounds great. I continue to work hard. I continue to get better at chess, and I lose 150 points. And I'm like, whoa, USCF, what are you doing? Like, especially with when the ratings are so weird, where like I go 3 wins and a loss and I lose 17 points. And I'm like, what? How is this even possible? And then I look and it's like, oh, right. I played that kid that was rated 1000. Flash forward 6 months later, he's 1800 now, right? Like, that's why, like, he was in the finals against me, like, trying to win the tournament, but because his rating was so low, I lost rating points. I was like, USCF, what are you guys even doing over there? And they're like, I don't know, we weren't ready for this whole chess boom thing. We're just hanging on with our rating system. That's so I don't really know how to answer that question, Jesse. I would like to just get better at chess, and as I do, if I do get better, it would be great if my rating was like, hey, man, you got better. And as such, your rating got better.
All I know is it would be cool if you had a goal. Like, for example, after I made GM, that was a great goal to have. It focused everything in my life. We're going to go for this goal. After I made GM, it was kind of hard. It's kind of hard because I'm like, well, what am I doing? You know, am I trying to gain like 20 points or something? Is that what it is? It's that very ephemeral that way.
Yeah.
And then now, like, let's say the senior stuff, well, that's a cool goal to have, right? And I don't know where you are now, but like 2000, that's a great goal. Yeah. I've coached several people to 2000, and I can tell you that's a hard road. A lot of times people they'll come to me and they're rated 1300 and they'll be like, Cry, I want you to take me to master, you know? And I'm like, boss, let's slow it down. Yeah. Let's slow it down. First of all, let me tell you, 2000 is kind of a long road right there, you know? 100 points in a year would be amazing if we achieved that. Let me ask, where are you at now?
With my 43 point gain, I went back to 1623. My high was 1746.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I really have 3 goals. My goals are 1800, 2000, and then the stretch goal is the elusive master, right? I realize the stretch goal is probably out of reach, but those are my 3 shorter term goals. And I thought like 1800 was mine. I was 1750. I was beating 1800s regularly. Mm-hmm. I was like, I am 1800. My rating just hasn't caught up. And then it was like, no, man, you're actually 1580 now. And I was like, whoa, what?
Yeah. No, you should. I'm just, as a, you know, I'm somebody who's been there, 1800, start there. Forget about everything else. Okay. Start with 1800. And if you could have, I don't know, some local goal of winning your club championship or whatever it is, you know, that will help you get to 800. It will make it more meaningful to get there, you know?
Okay. I like that.
And I'm sure you can play in the senior. Are you a Northern or Southern California?
Southern California.
Yeah, I'm sure you could play in it, the senior championship. The senior qualification they have going on.
Oh, in Southern California. I can't even find anything. I started doing research and I couldn't find anything. So I'll have to do more research. It seems like we have to have some sort of senior championship.
Right, dude. Yeah.
But maybe it's in like a basement somewhere and you have to know people.
It's an evolving thing too. You know, you could probably maybe contribute to, you know, making it a cool tournament. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe I could we could make it the Chess Journeys Senior Championship.
Yeah.
That'd be fun. Okay. I've got a Patreon question, if you don't mind. I think this will be our last question today. All right. So Rich Burgess says that it seems to me that serious chess improvement, whether in pursuit of a title or not, has an opportunity cost associated with it. So I'm interested in Jesse Cry's thoughts on what sacrifices one should and should not make in pursuit of serious improvement. I guess, in other words, should you throw it all away or should you put up some guardrails here while you're trying to do your improvement?
Well, first of all, anything you do in life has an opportunity cost. Doesn't matter what it is, right? Any choice you make has an opportunity cost. You know, it depends a little bit on your station in life, what the opportunity cost is going to be, you know? Like, for example, if you are retired and you have some money, then money's not going to be your problem, right? If you're younger and you're still like, you know, you don't have your situation settled, well, that's obviously going to be your opportunity cost, right? And it costs money to say, go to tournaments. Yeah. Money is involved, you know? I think one of the cool things about chess throughout my life that's been cool is that it's kind of kept me straight in a physical sense, i.e. I've never turned, drinking was not too high up on my list. Staying fit is kind of a cool thing. Like you, and especially if you can turn 50, you got to stay fit. You could see it there. Like the fitness quotient it's always a big deal. When you go to that 50 plus section, boss, you see it right away. There are some differences. There's some differences in people's fitness levels. Anyways, that was a little bit of an aside. I guess I mentioned that because there's a positive to pursuing a journey like that. Right. There's like a way in which it's going to structure your life in a positive way if you really are committed to being better with it. I think there's also a level of satisfaction, especially if you're doing deep work. Blitz, I don't think, brings it for anybody, but if you do some deep work, it's like the rest of the day is kind of like you did a workout, you know, like, oh, there's a fulfillment there. And you kind of just feel better about your situation. There's a social cost, I will say. You know, I go off 2 weekends. Oh, buddy, I was like, and then I get back and then I got to do 2 weekends with the kids. What's going on? Well, what about me? What about my life, buddy? I wanted to go hang out and have fun in the sun. Oh, not for me, you know? So yeah, there's the social cost there. And you know, there used to be a social cost and it was kind of stigmatized. And now it's cool that it's not, or less so. Right. If I tell somebody I meet that I'm, you know, do chess for a living, they don't, you know, freak out anymore. They'll say, what? What are you talking about?
Terrible life choices.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. I see that in the high school, even. It's funny how it used to be like, if you played chess, you were looked down upon. And this past year, there was like this one kid that didn't play chess. And everyone was like, what do you mean? You don't play chess. Right. And he's like, I don't know. I just don't like it. And they're like, how could you not like it? And I was like, wait, you're bullying him for not playing chess? What is happening right now?
Right.
Yeah, that part's really interesting. So I guess, do you feel like that's something you should be thinking about? Is like, okay, what am I giving up to pursue this? How much am I giving up? Like, am I giving up time spent with my family, chances of career opportunities? Are you thinking this is something you should be cognizant of? Or I don't know. Chess can be kind of a swallowing thing, right? Where you're just like studying, playing. And then you kind of look up and you're like, oh wait, like everything fell apart around me while I was like in my cave studying.
Right. Okay. Here's an interesting thing. And this is more a question than an answer. I feel like, you know, for example, I, commit a part of my day every day to some kind of fitness regime, right? And that seems to be like, it's not something that people would question because it seems obvious. Like maybe they wouldn't do it themselves, but it seems obvious why you would invest the time to keep yourself kind of healthy, right? Well, with chess, it's a little bit less obvious. If you wanted to tell yourself a story, it would be like, well, I'm keeping my brain active. Is that true though? I don't know. I don't actually know if it's true. There might be though some scientific study tells you that at some point. It sometimes feels true, but it also produces like a, out of touch professor phenomenon, you know, where my mind is kind of spinning its wheels somewhere else and someone's talking to me about, you know, what else are the, you know, more concrete happening in life. So I think that's one of the tricky things about chess is it's not immediately evident that there's going to be a payback in the same way that there is with fitness. And it, especially as we get older, we need some kind of positive reinforcement or else you're going to give up, right? Like with fitness, you can see it. With chess, it's oftentimes not so visible, right? You know, and honestly, maybe another metaphor would be, well, with fitness, when you're over 50, you're kind of just trying to maintain as well. And then you could try to pretend about gains. And sometimes there's some gains, right? But then with chess as well, like, dude, maybe you're just trying to maintain at this point, you know? That's why I think 18 under for you, that would be a great achievement. That'd be fantastic.
Okay. Interesting. A lot of stuff to think about there. I like it. All right, Jesse. As we wrap up here, if people want to get in contact with you, do you think going through the Chess Dojo is the best place to do that?
Yeah, Chess Dojo for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, so check it out.
We recommend the Chess Dojo. I've used it. It's great. Jesse runs it. It's great. You can contact him there. All right, Jesse. Well, thanks so much for taking the time out to give your thoughts, your ideas, adult improvement. Let us know about your own journey. It's been a fascinating conversation.
For sure.
All right. For those of you out there, I hope this is the week where you gain 40 points in one tournament and not the week where you lose 150 points because you played a bunch of juniors who are underrated. And come back next week and we'll have another guest to help you along your journey. I'll see you later, everybody. Have a good one.